in this case, interpret. The old man twisted the wax tips of his grey moustaches between finger and thumb. You wishes to visit a plague upon the settlers of the near country. You wishes to make stern examples of every rebel sheltered and every person who gives them shelter. You wishes to make them understand that their only future is with the grace and favour of His August Majesty. You wishes to force them into the welcoming arms of the Union. Do I come close to the mark?
Close enough, murmured Superior Pike. Temple found that he was sweating. When he wiped his forehead, his hand trembled. But what could he do?
The paper of engagement is already prepared.
Lawson produced his own sheaf of crackling documents, a heavy seal of red wax upon its bottom corner.
Cosco waved it away.
My notary will look it over. All the legal fiddle-faddle quite swims before my eyes. I'm a simple soldier.
Admirable, said Pike, his hairless brows raised by the slightest fraction.
Temple's ink-spotted forefinger traced through the blocks of calligraphy, eyes flickering from one point of interest to another. He realized he was picking nervously at the corners of the pages and made himself stop.
I will accompany you on the expedition, said Lawson. I have a list of settlements suspected of harbouring rebels, or rebellious sentiment.
Cosco grinned.
Nothing more dangerous than sentiment.
In particular, His Eminence the Archlector offers a bonus of 50,000 marks for the capture, alive, of the chief instigator of the insurrection, the one the rebels call Consus. He goes also under the name of Simok. The ghosts call him Black Grass. At the massacre in Rostad, he used the alias...
No further aliases, I beg you.
Cosco massaged the sides of his skull as if they pained him.
Since suffering a head wound at the Battle of Afieri, I have been cursed with an appalling memory for names. It is a source of constant embarrassment. But Sergeant Friendly has all the details. If your man... conscious...
Consus.
What did I say?
Conscious.
There you go. If he's in the near country, he'll be yours.
Alive, snapped Lawson. He must answer for his crimes. He must be made a lesson of. He must be put on display.
And he'll make a most educational show, I'm sure.
Pike flicked another pinch of crumbs to his gathering flock.
The methods we leave to you, Captain General. We would only ask that there be something left in the ashes to annex.
As long as you realize a company of mercenaries is more club than scalpel.
His Eminence has chosen the method and understands its limitations.
An inspirational man, the Archlector. We are close friends, you know.
His one firm stipulation clear in the contract, as you see, is that you avoid any imperial entanglements, any and all. Am I understood?
That grating note entered Pike's voice again.
Legate Samis still haunts the border like an angry phantom. I do not suppose he will cross it, but even so, he is a man decidedly not to be trifled with, a most bloody-minded and bloody-handed adversary. His Eminence desires no further wars at present.
Do not concern yourself. I avoid fighting wherever possible.
Cosco slapped happily at the hilt of his blade.
A sword is for rattling, not for drawing, eh?
We have a gift for you also.
Superior Pike indicated the fortified wagon, an oaken monster bound in riveted iron and hauled by a team of 8 muscular horses. It was halfway between conveyance and castle, with slitted windows and a crenellated parapet about the top, from which defenders might presumably shoot at circling enemies. Far from the most practical of gifts, but then Cosco had never been interested in practicalities.
For me?
The old man pressed his withered hands to his gilded breastplate.
It shall be my home from home, out in the wilderness.
There is a secret within, said Lawson. Something His Eminence would very much like to see tested.
I love surprises. Ones that don't involve armed men behind me, anyway. You may tell His Eminence it will be my honour.
Koska stood, wincing as his aged knees audibly clicked.
How does the paper of engagement appear?
Temple looked up from the penultimate page. The contract was closely based on the one he had drawn up for their previous engagement, was watertight in every particular, was even more generous in several.
Some issues with supply, he stammered, fumbling for objections. Food and weaponry are covered, but the clause really should include...
Details. No cause for delay. Let's get the papers signed and the men ready to move. The longer they sit idle, the harder to get them off their asses. No force of nature so dangerous to life and commerce as mercenaries without employment.
Except, perhaps, mercenaries with employment.
It would be prudent to allow me a little longer to...
Koska came close, setting his hand on Temple's shoulder again.
Have you a legal objection?
Temple paused, clutching for some words which might carry weight with a man with whom nothing carried any weight.
Not a legal objection, no.
A financial objection?
Offered Koska.
No, General.
Then...
Do you remember when we first met?
Koska suddenly flashed that luminous smile, of which only he was capable, good humour and good intentions radiating from his deep-lined face.
Of course! I wore that blue uniform, you the brown rags.
You said, it hardly felt possible now, you said we would do good together.
And haven't we, in the main? Legally and financially?
As though the entire spectrum of goodness ranged between those twin poles.
And morally?
The old man's forehead furrowed as though it was a word in a foreign tongue.
Morally?
General, please.
Temple fixed Koska with his most earnest expression, and Temple knew he could be earnest when he truly believed, or had a great deal to lose.
I beg you, do not sign this paper. This will not be war, it will be murder.
Koska's brows went up.
A fine distinction to the buried.
We are not judges. What happens to the people of these towns once the men get among them hungry for plunder? Women and children, General, who had no part in any rebellion. We are better than this.
We are? You did not say so in Kadir. You persuaded me to sign that contract, if I recall.
Well,
and in Styria, was it not you who encouraged me to take back what was mine?
You had a valid claim.
Before we took ship to the north, you helped me persuade the men. You can be damned persuasive when you have a mind.
Then let me persuade you now. Please, General Koska, do not sign.
There was a long pause. Koska heaved in a breath, his forehead creasing yet more deeply.
A conscientious objection, then.
Conscience is, muttered Temple hopefully, a splinter of the divine?
Not to mention a shitty navigator, and it had led him into some dangerous waters now. He realized he was picking nervously at the hem of his shirt as Koska gazed upon him.
I simply have a feeling this job...
He struggled for words that might turn the tide of inevitability.
...will go bad,
he finished lamely.
Good jobs rarely require the services of mercenaries.
Koska's hand squeezed a little tighter at his shoulder, and Temple felt Friendly's looming presence behind him. Still and silent, and yet very much there.
Men of conscience and conviction might find themselves better suited to other lines of work. His Majesty's Inquisition offers a righteous cause, I understand.
Temple swallowed as he looked across at Superior Pike, who had now attracted a twittering avian crowd.
I'm not sure I care for their brand of righteousness.
Well, that's the thing about righteousness,
murmured Koska.
Everyone has their own brand. Gold, on the other hand, is universal. In my considerable experience, a man is better off worrying about what is good for his purse than what is simply good.
I just... Koska squeezed still more firmly.
Without wishing to be harsh, Temple, it isn't all about you. I have the welfare of the whole company to think of. 500 men.
512, said Friendly.
Plus one with dysentery. I cannot inconvenience them for the sake of your feelings. That would be immoral. I need you, Temple, but if you wish to leave...
Koska issued a weighty sigh.
In spite of all your promises, in spite of my generosity, in spite of everything we've been through together, well...
He held out an arm towards burning Molkova and raised his brows.
I suppose the door is always open.
Temple swallowed. He could have left. He could have said he wanted no part of this. Enough is enough, damn it. But that would have taken courage. That would have left him with no armed men at his back, alone and weak and a victim once again. That would have been hard to do. And Temple always took the easy way, even when he knew it was the wrong way. Especially then, in fact, since easy and wrong make such good company. Even when he had a damn good notion it would end up being the hard way, even then. Why think about tomorrow, when today is such a thorny business? Perhaps Cardia would have found some way to stop this, something involving supreme self-sacrifice, most likely. Temple, it hardly needed to be said, was not Cardia. He wiped away a fresh sheen of sweat, forced a queasy smile onto his face, and bowed.
I remain always honored to serve.
Excellent!
And Koska plucked the contract from Temple's limp hand and spread it out to sign upon a sheared-off column. Superior Pike stood, brushing crumbs from his shapeless black coat and sending birds scattering.
Do you know what's out there in the west?
He let the question hang a moment. Below them, the faint jingling, groaning, snapping could be heard of his practicals dragging the prisoners away. Then he answered himself. The future. And the future does not belong to the old empire. Their time is 1,000 years past. Nor does it belong to the ghosts, savages that they are. Nor does it belong to the fugitives, adventurers, and opportunist scum who have put the first grasping roots into its virgin soil. No, the future belongs to the Union. We must seize it.
We must not be afraid to do what is necessary to seize it, added Lawson.
Never fear, gentlemen.
Koska grinned as he scratched out the parting swirl of his signature.
We will seize the future together.
Just men. The rain had stopped. Shai peered through trees alive with the tap-tap of falling water, past a felled trunk abandoned on its trestles, part stripped, the draw knife left wedged under a curl of bark, and towards the blackened bones of the house.
Not hard bastards to follow, muttered Lamb. Leave burned-out buildings wherever they go.
Probably they thought they'd killed anyone cared enough to follow. What might happen once they noticed Lamb and Shai toddling after in their rickety wagon, she was trying not to think about. Time was, she'd thought out everything, every moment of every day. Hers, Lamb's, Gully's, Pit and Rose, too. All parcelled into its proper place with its proper purpose. Always looking forwards, the future better than the now, its shape clear to her as a house already built. Hard to believe since that time it was just 5 nights spent under the flapping canvas in the back of the cart. 5 mornings waking stiff and sore to a dawn like a pit yawning under her feet. 5 days following the sign across the empty grassland and into the woods, one eye on her black past, wondering what part of it had crept from the cold earth's clutches and stolen her life while she was grinning at tomorrow. Her fingertips rubbed nervously against her palm. "Shall we take a look?" Truth was, she was scared what she might find, scared of looking and scared of not looking, worn out and scared of everything, with a hollow space where her hopes used to be. "I'll go round the back." Lamb brushed his knees off with his hat and started circling the clearing, twigs crunching under his boots, a set of startled pigeons yammering into the white sky, giving anyone about fair notice of their arrival. Not that there was anyone about, leastways no one living. There was an overgrown vegetable patch out back, stubborn soil scraped away to make a trench no more than ankle deep. Next to it, a soaked blanket was stretched over something lumpy. From the bottom stuck a pair of boots and a pair of bony bare feet with dirt under the bluish nails. Lamb squatted down, took one corner and peeled it back. A man's face and a woman's, grey and slack, both with throats cut deep. The woman's head lolled, the wound in her neck yawned wet and purple. "Ah!" Shai pressed her tongue into the gap between her front teeth and stared at the ground. Would have taken quite the optimist to expect anything else, and she by no means qualified, but those faces still tore at something in her. Worry for Pitten Row, or worry for herself, or just a sick memory of a sick time when bodies weren't such strange things for her to see.
"Leave 'em be, you bastards!"
First thing Shai took in was the gleam on the arrowhead. Next was the hand that held the drawn bow, knuckles white on dark wood. Last was the face behind. A boy, maybe 16, a mop of sandy hair stuck to pale skin with the wet.
"I'll kill you! I'll do it!"
He eased from the bushes, feet fishing for firm earth to tread on, shadows sliding across his tight face and his hand trembling on the bow. Shai made herself stay still, some trick to manage, with her first two burning instincts to get at him or get away. Her every muscle was itching to do one or the other, and there'd been a time Shai had chased off wherever her instincts led. But since they'd usually led her by an unpleasant route right into the shit, she let the bastards run off without her this time, and just stood, looking this boy steady in the eyes. Scared eyes, which was no surprise, open wide and shining in the corners. She kept her voice soft, like they'd met at a harvest dance, and had no burned-out buildings, dead folk, or drawn bows between them. "What's your name?" His tongue darted over his lips, point of the arrow wobbling and making her chest horrible itchy about where it was aimed.
"I'm Shai. This is Lamb."
The boy's eyes flicked across, and his bow, too. Lamb didn't flinch, just put the blanket back how he'd found it, and slowly stood. Seeing him with the boy's fresh eyes, he looked anything but harmless. Even with that tangle of grey beard, you could tell a man would have to be real careless with his razor to pick up scars like Lamb's by accident. Shai had always guessed he'd got them in some war up north, but if he'd been a fighter once, there was no fight in him now. Some kind of coward, like she'd always said, but this boy wasn't to know.
"We've been following some men."
Shai kept her voice soft, soft, coaxing the boy's eyes and his arrow's point back to her.
"They burned our farm up near Square Deal. They burned it, and they killed a man worked for us, and they took my sister and my little brother."
Her voice cracked, and she had to swallow and press it out smooth again.
"We've been following on."
"Reckon they've been here, too," said Lamb.
"We've been tracking 'em. Maybe 20 men moving quick."
The arrow point started to drift down.
"They stopped off at a couple more farms on the way. Same thing. Then we followed them into the woods, and here." I've been hunting, said the boy quietly. She nodded. We were in town, selling our crop. I came back, and...
That point made it right down to the ground, much to Shai's relief.
Nothing I could have done. No. They took my brother.
What was his name?
Evan. He was 9 years old.
Silence, with just the trees still dripping and the gentle creak as the boy let his bowstring go slack.
You know who they were? Asked Lamb.
I didn't see them.
You know why they took your brother?
I said I wasn't here, didn't I? I wasn't here.
All right, said Shai, calming.
I know. You following after him? Asked the boy.
We're just about keeping up, said Lamb.
Gonna get your sister and your brother back?
Count on it, said Shai, as if sounding certain made it certain.
Can you get mine too?
Shai looked at Lamb, and he looked back, and he didn't say nothing.
We can try, she said. Reckon I'll be coming along with you then.
Another silence.
You sure? Asked Flam.
I can do what needs doing, you old bastard!
Screamed the boy, veins popping from his neck. Lamb didn't twitch a muscle.
We don't know what'll need doing yet.
There's room in the wagon, though, if you want to take your part.
Shai held her hand out to the boy, and he looked at it for a moment, then stepped forward and shook it. He squeezed it too hard, that way men do when they're trying to prove they're tougher than they are.
My name's Leif.
Shai nodded towards the two bodies.
These your folks?
The boy blinked down at them.
I've been trying to do the burying, but the ground's hard, and I've got nothing to dig with.
He rubbed at his broken fingernails with his thumb.
I've been trying.
Need some help? She asked. His face crushed up, and he hung his head, and he nodded, wet hair dangling.
We all need some help, time to time, said Lamb. I'll get them shovels down.
Shai reached out, checked a moment, then gently put her hand on the boy's shoulder. She felt him tense, thought he'd shake it off, but he didn't, and she was glad. Maybe she needed it there more than he did. On they went, gone from 2 to 3, but otherwise not much changed. Same wind, same sky, same tracks to be followed, same worried silence between them. The wagon was wearing out on the battered tracks, lurching more with each mile rattled behind those patient oxen. One of the wheels had near shook itself to pieces inside its iron tire. Shai felt some sympathy. Behind her frown, she was all shook to pieces herself. They loaded out the gear and let the oxen loose to crop grass, and Lamb lifted one side of the wagon with a grunt and a shrug, while Shai did the best she could with the tools she had and her half-sack of nails, Leif eager to do his part, but that no more than passing her the hammer when she asked. The tracks led to a river and forded at a shallow spot. Calder and Scale weren't too keen on the crossing, but in the end Shai goaded them over to a tall mill house, stone-built on 3 stories. Those they were chasing hadn't bothered to try and burn this one, and its wheels still slapped around merrily in the chattering water. 2 men and a woman were hanged together in a bunch from the attic window. One had a broken neck stretched out way too long, another feet burned raw, dangling astride above the mud. Leif stared up, big-eyed.
What kind of men do a thing like this?
Just man, said Shai. Things like this don't take no one special. Though at times it felt to her that they were following something else, some mad storm blowing mindless through this abandoned country, churning up the dirt and leaving bottles and shit and burned buildings and hanged folks scattered in its wake. A storm that snatched away all the children, to who knew where and to what purpose.
You care to go up there, Leif, and cut these folks down?
He looked like he didn't much care to, but he drew his knife and went inside to do it anyway.
"Feels like we're doing a lot of burying lately," she muttered.
"Good thing you got clay to throw them shovels in," said Lamb.
She laughed at that, then realized what she was laughing at, and turned it into an ugly cough. Leaf's head showed at the window, and he leaned out, started cutting at the ropes, making the bodies tremble.
"Seems wrong, us having to clean up after these bastards."
"Someone has to."
Lamb held one of the shovels out to her.
"Or do you want to leave these folks swinging?"
Towards evening, the low sun setting the edges of the clouds to burn, and the wind making the trees dance and sweeping patterns in the grass, they came upon a campsite. A big fire had smouldered out under the eaves of a wood, a circle of charred branches and sodden ash 3 strides across. Shy hopped from the wagon, while Lamb was still cooing Scale and Calder to a snorting halt, and she drew her knife and gave the fire a poke, turned up some embers still aglow.
"They were here overnight," she called. "We're catching them, then?"
asked Leaf as he jumped down, knocking an arrow loose to his bow.
"I reckon."
Though Shy couldn't help wondering if that was a good thing. She dragged a length of frayed rope from the grass, found a cobweb torn between bushes at the tree line, then a shred of cloth left on a bramble.
"Someone come this way?" asked Leaf. "More than one, and fast."
Shy slipped through after, keeping low, crept down a muddy slope, slick dirt and fallen leaves treacherous under her boots, trying to keep her balance and peer into the dimness. She saw Pitt, face down by a fallen tree, looking so small there among the knotted roots. She wanted to scream, but had no voice, no breath even. She ran, slid on her side in a shower of dead leaves, and ran again. She squatted by him, back of his head a clotted mass, hand trembling as she reached out, not wanting to see his face, having to see it. She held her breath as she wrestled him over, his body small but stiff as a board, brushed away the leaves stuck to his face with fumbling fingers.
"Is it your brother?"
muttered Leaf.
"No."
She was almost sick with relief, then with guilt that she was relieved when this boy was dead.
"Is it yours?"
"No,"
said Leaf. Shy slid her hands under the dead child and picked him up, struggled up the slope, Leaf behind her. Lamb stood staring between the trees at the top, a black shape stamped from the glow of sunset.
"Is it him?"
came his cracking voice.
"Is it Pitt?"
"No."
Shy laid him on the flattened grass, arms stuck out wide, head tipped back rigid.
"By the dead."
Lamb had his fingers shoved into his grey hair, gripping at his head like it might burst.
"Might be he tried to get away. They made a lesson of him."
She hoped Roe didn't try it. Hoped she was too clever to. Hoped she was cleverer than Shy had been at her age. She leaned on the wagon with her back to the others, squeezed her eyes shut, and wiped the tears away. Dug the bastard shovels out and brought them back.
"More fucking digging,"
spat Leaf, hacking at the ground like it was the one stole his brother.
"Better off digging than getting buried," said Lamb.
Shy left them to the graves, and the oxen to their grazing, and spread out in circles, keeping low, fingers combing at the cold grass, trying to read the signs in the fading light, trying to feel out what they'd done, what they'd do next.
"Lamb,"
he grunted as he squatted beside her, slapping the dirt from his gloves.
"What is it?"
"Looks like 3 of them peeled off here, heading south and east. The rest struck on due west. What do you think?"
"I try not to. You're the tracker. Though when you got so damn good at it, I've no notion."
"Just a question of thinking it through."
Shy didn't want to admit that chasing men and being chased are sides to one coin, and at being chased she'd 2 years of the harshest practice.
"They split up,"
asked Leif. Lam fussed at that notch out of his ear as he looked off south.
Some style of a disagreement? Could be. Or maybe they sent him to circle around, check if anyone was following.
Leif fumbled for an arrow, eyes darting about the horizon. Lam waved him down.
If they'd a mind to check, they'd have seen us by now.
He kept looking south, off along the tree line towards a low ridge, the way Shai thought those three had gone.
No. I reckon they had enough. Maybe it all went too far for them. Maybe they started thinking they might be the next left hanging. Either way, we'll follow. Hope to catch him before the wheels come off this cart for good. Or off me, either,
he added as he dragged himself up, wincing into the wagon seat.
The children ain't with those three, said Leif, turning sullen.
No. Lam settled his hat back on. But they might point us the right way. We need to get this wagon fixed up proper, find some new oxen, or get ourselves some horses. We need food. Might be those three.
You fucking old coward!
There was a pause, then Lam nodded over at Shai.
Me and her spent years chewing over that topic, and you got naught worth adding to the conversation.
Shai looked at them. The boy stood on the ground, glowering up, the big old man looking down calm and even from his seat. Leif curled his lip.
We need to keep after the children or...
Get up on the wagon, boy, or you'll be keeping after the children alone.
Leif opened his mouth again, but Shai caught him by the arm first.
I want to catch him just as much as you. But Lam's right. There's 20 men out there, bad men, and armed, and willing. There's nothing we could do. We gotta catch him sooner or later, don't we?
Snapped Leif, breathing hard.
Might as well be now, while my brother and yours are still alive.
Shai had to admit he'd a point, but there was no help for it. She held his eye and said it to his face, calm but with no give.
Get on the wagon, Leif.
This time he did as he was told, and clambered up among their gear, and sat there silent with his back to them. Shai perched her bruised ass next to Lam as he snapped the reins and got Scale and Calder reluctantly on the move.
What do we do if we catch these three?
She muttered, keeping her voice down so Leif wouldn't hear it.
Chances are they're going to be armed and willing to. Better armed than us, that's sure.
Reckon we'll have to be more willing then.
Her brows went up at that. This big, gentle Northman who used to run laughing through the wheat with Pit on one shoulder and Roe on the other, used to sit out at sunset with Gully, passing a bottle between them in silence for hours at a time, who'd never once laid a hand on her growing up, in spite of some sore provocations, talking about getting red to the elbows like it was nothing. Shai knew it wasn't nothing. She closed her eyes and remembered Jeg's face after she stabbed him, bloody hat brim jammed down over his eyes, pitching in the street, still muttering, "Smoke, smoke." That clerk in the store staring at her as his shirt turned black. The look Dodd had as he gawped down at her arrow in his chest.
What did you do that for?
She rubbed her face hard with one hand, sweating of a sudden, heart banging in her ears, hard as it had then, and she twisted inside her greasy clothes like she could twist free of the past. But it had good and caught her up. For Pitt and Rose's sake, she had to get her hands red again. She curled her fingers around the grip of her knife, took a hard breath, and set her jaw. No choice then. No choice now. And for men, the likes of the ones they followed, no tears needed shedding.
When we find him,
a voice sounding tiny in the gathering darkness,
can you follow my lead?
No, said Lam.
Eh?
He'd been following her lead so long, she'd never thought he might find some other path. When she looked at him, his old scarred face was twisted like he was in pain.
I made a promise to your mother. before she died. Made a promise to look to her children, Pitt and Roe. And I reckon it covers you too, don't it?
I guess,
she muttered, far from reassured. I broke a lot of promises in my life. Let them wash away like leaves on the water. He rubbed at his eyes with the back of one gloved hand. I mean to keep that one. So when we find them, you'll be following my lead, this time.
All right.
She could say so, if it helped him. Then she could do what needed doing.
The Best Man.
I believe this is Square Deal, said Inquisitor Lawson, frowning at his map.
And is Square Deal on the Superior's list?
Asked Koska. It is. Lawson made sure there was nothing in his voice that could be interpreted as uncertainty. He was the only man within 100 miles in possession of anything resembling a cause. He could entertain no doubts. Superior Pike had said the future was out here in the West, but the town of Square Deal did not look like the future, through Inquisitor Lawson's eyeglass. It did not look like a present anyone with the choice would want a part in. The people scratching a living out of the near country were even poorer than he had expected. Fugitives and outcasts, misfits and failures. Poor enough that supporting a rebellion against the world's most powerful nation was unlikely to be their first priority. But Lawson could not concern himself with likelihoods. Allowances, explanations, and compromises were likewise unaffordable luxuries. He had learned over many painful years managing a prison camp in England that people had to be sorted onto the right side or the wrong, and those on the wrong could be given no mercy. He took no pleasure in it, but a better world comes at a price. He folded his map, scored the sharp crease with the back of his thumbnail, and thrust it inside his coat.
Get your men ready to attack, General.
Lawson was surprised to see, on glancing sideways, that Koska was in the middle of sipping from a metal flask.
Isn't it a little early for spirits?
He forced through clenched teeth. It was, after all, but an hour or two after dawn. Koska shrugged.
A good thing at tea time is surely a good thing at breakfast, too.
Likewise, a bad thing, grated Lawson.
Heedless, Koska took another taste and noisily smacked his lips.
Though it might be best if you didn't mention this to Temple. He worries, bless him. He thinks of me almost as a father. He was in some extremity when I came upon him, you know.
Fascinating, snapped Lawson. Get your men ready.
Right away, Inquisitor.
The venerable mercenary screwed the cap back on, tightly, as if he was resolved never again to unscrew it, then began, with much stiffness and little dignity, to slither down the hillside. He gave every impression of being a loathsome man, and one who the rude hand of time had in no way improved. Inexpressibly vain, trustworthy as a scorpion, and an utter stranger to morality. But after a few days with the company of the Gracious Hand, Inquisitor Lawson had regretfully concluded that Koska, or the Old Man as he was fondly known, might be the best among them. His direct underlings offered no counter-arguments. Captain Braccio was a vile Styrian with an eye made always weepy by an old wound. He was a fine rider, but fat as a house, and had turned self-serving indolence into a religion. Captain Joubert, a hulking, tar-black cantic, had done the opposite and turned religion into self-serving madness. Rumour had it he was an ex-slave who had once fought in a pit. Though now far removed, Lawson suspected some part of the pit remained within him. Captain Dimbic was at least a Union man, but a reject from the army for incompetence, and a weak-chinned, petulant one at that, who felt the need to affect a threadbare sash as a reminder of past glories. Though balding, he had grown his hair long, and, rather than merely bald, he now looked both bald and a fool.
As far as Lawson could tell, none of them truly believed in anything but their own profit. Notwithstanding Koska's affection, the lawyer, Temple, was the worst of the crew, celebrating selfishness, greed, and underhanded manipulation as virtues. A man so slimy he could have found employment as axle grease. Lawson shuddered as he looked across the other faces swarming about Superior Pike's huge fortified wagon. Wretched leavings of every race and mongrel combination, variously scarred, diseased, besmirched, all leering in anticipation of plunder and violence. But filthy tools can be put to righteous purposes, can they not, and achieve noble ends? He hoped it would prove so. The rebel Conthus was hiding somewhere in this forsaken land, skulking and plotting more sedition and massacre. He had to be rooted out, whatever the costs. He had to be made an example of, so that Lawson could reap the glory of his capture. He took one last look through his eyeglass towards Square Deal, all still quiet, before snapping it closed and working his way down the slope. Temple was talking softly to Koska at the bottom, a whining note in his voice which Lawson found especially aggravating.
"Couldn't we maybe talk to the townspeople?"
"We will," said Koska, "as soon as we've secured forage."
"Robbed them, you mean?"
Koska slapped Temple on the arm.
"You lawyers! You see straight to the heart of things!
There must be a better way.
I have spent my life searching for one, and the search has led me here. We signed a contract, Temple, as you well know, and Inquisitor Lawson means to see us keep our end of the bargain, eh, Inquisitor?"
"I will insist upon it," grated Lawson, treating Temple to a poisonous glare.
"If you wanted to avoid bloodshed," said Koska, "you really should have spoken up beforehand."
The lawyer blinked.
"I did."
The old man raised helpless palms to indicate the mercenaries arming, mounting, drinking, and otherwise preparing themselves for violence.
"Not eloquently enough, evidently. How many men have we fit to fight?"
432, said Friendly instantly.
The necklace sergeant appeared to Lawson to have two uncanny specialities, silent menace and numbers.
"Aside from the 64 who chose not to join the expedition, there have been 11 deserters since we left Morkova, and 5 taken ill."
Koska shrugged them away.
"Some wastage is inevitable. The fewer our numbers, the greater each share of glory, eh, Swarbrick?"
The writer, a ludicrous indulgence on this expedition, looked anything but convinced.
"I suppose..."
"Glory is hard to count," said Friendly.
"So true," lamented Koska. "Like honour and virtue and all those other desirable intangibles. But the fewer our numbers, the greater each share of the profits, too."
"Profits can be counted."
"And weighed, and felt, and held up to the light," said Captain Braccio, rubbing gently at his capacious belly.
"The logical extension of the argument,"
Koska twisted the waxed points of his moustaches sharp,
"would be that all the high ideals in existence are not worth as much as a single bit."
Lawson shivered with the most profound disgust.
"That is a world I could not bear to live in."
The old man grinned.
"And yet, here you are. Is Joubert in position?"
"Soon," grunted Braccio. "We're waiting for his signal."
Lawson took a breath through gritted teeth. A crowd of madmen awaiting the signal of the maddest.
"It is not too late."
Sophine spoke softly so the others could not hear.
"We could stop this."
"Why should we?"
Joubert drew his sword and saw the fear in Sophine's eyes and felt a pity and a contempt for him. Fear was born of arrogance, of a belief that everything was not the will of God and could be changed.
but nothing could be changed. Joubert had accepted that many years ago. Since then, he and Fear had been entire strangers to each other.
"This is what God wants," he said.
Most men refused to see the truth. Sophine stared at him as though he was mad.
"Why would it be God's desire to punish the innocent?"
"Innocence is not for you to judge, nor is it given to man to understand God's design. If he desires someone saved, he need only turn my sword aside."
Sophine slowly shook his head.
"If that is your God, I do not believe in him."
"What kind of God would he be if your belief could make the slightest difference, or mine, or anyone's?"
Joubert lifted the blade, patchy sunlight shining down the long straight edge, glinting in the many nicks and notches.
"Disbelieve this sword, it will still cut you. He is God. We all walk his path regardless."
Sophine shook his little head again, as though that might change the way of things.
"What priest taught you this?"
"I have seen how the world is, and judged for myself how it must be."
He glanced over his shoulder, his men gathering in the wood, armor, and weapons prepared for the work, faces eager.
"Are we ready to attack?"
"I've been down there."
Sophine pointed through the brush towards Square Deal.
"They have 3 constables, and 2 are idiots. I'm not sure anything so vigorous as an attack is really necessary, are you?"
It was true there were few defences. A fence of rough-cut logs had once ringed the town, but had been partly torn down to allow for growth. The roof of the wooden watchtower was crusted with moss, and someone had secured their washing line to one of its supports. The ghosts had long ago been driven out of this country, and the townsfolk evidently expected no other threat. They would soon discover their error. Joubert's eyes slid back to Sophine.
"I tire of your carping. Give the signal."
The scout had reluctance in his eyes and bitterness, but he obeyed, taking out the mirror and crawling to the edge of the tree line to signal Koska and the others. That was well for him. If he had not obeyed, Joubert would most likely have killed him, and he would have been right so to do. He tipped his head back and smiled at the blue sky through the black branches, the black leaves. He could do anything, and it would be right, for he had made himself a willing puppet of God's purpose, and in so doing, freed himself. He, alone free, surrounded by slaves. He was the best man in the near country, the best man in the circle of the world. He had no fear, for God was with him. God was everywhere, always. How could it be otherwise? Checking he wasn't observed, Braccio tugged the locket from his shirt and snapped it open. The 2 tiny portraits were blistered and faded till anyone else would have seen little more than smudges, but Braccio knew them. He touched those faces with a gentle fingertip, and in his mind they were as they'd been when he left, soft, perfect, and smiling. Too long ago.
"Don't worry, my babies," he cooed to them. "I'll be back soon."
A man has to choose what matters and leave everything else to the dogs. Worry about all of it and you'll do no good at all. He was the only man in the company with any sense. Dimbeck was a preening mope. Joubert and Sanity were entire strangers to each other. For all his craft and cunning, Koska was a dreamer. This shit with the biographer was proof enough of that. Braccio was the best of them because he knew what he was. No high ideals, no grand delusions. He was a sensible man with sensible ambitions, doing what he had to, and he was content. His daughters were all that mattered. New dresses and good food and good dowries and good lives. Better lives than the hell he'd lived.
"Captain Braccio!"
Koska's braying voice, loud as ever, snatched him back to the now.
There is the signal!
Braccio snapped the locket closed, wiped his damp eyes on the back of his fist, and straightened the bandolier that held his knives. Koska had wedged a boot in one stirrup, and now bounced once, twice, three times, before dragging on his gilt saddle horn. His bulging eyes came level with it before he froze.
Could somebody...
Sergeant Friendly slipped a hand under Koska's arse and twitched him effortlessly into the saddle. Once there, the old man spent a moment getting his wind back, then, with some effort, drew his blade and hefted it high.
"Unsheathe your swords!"
He considered that.
"Or cheaper weapons. Let us do some good!"
Braccio pointed towards the crest of the hill and bellowed,
"Ride!"
With a rousing cheer, the front rank spurred their horses and thundered off in a shower of dirt and dry grass. Koska, Lawson, Braccio and the rest, as befitted commanders, trotted after.
"That's it,"
Braccio heard Swarbrick muttering as the shabby valley and its patchy fields and the dusty little settlement came into view below. Maybe he'd been expecting a mile-high fortress with domes of gold and walls of adamant. Maybe it would have become one by the time he'd finished writing the scene.
"It looks..."
"Doesn't it?" snapped Temple. Braccio's Styrians were already streaming across the fields towards the town at a greedy gallop, while Joubert's Cantic swarmed at it from the other direction, their horses black dots against a rising storm of dust.
"Look at them go!"
Koska swept off his hat and gave it a wave.
"The brave boys, eh? There's vim and brio for you. How I wish I could still charge in there with the rest of them."
"Really?" Braccio remembered leading a charge, and it had been tough, sore, dangerous work, with vim and brio both conspicuous by their absence. Koska thought about it for a moment, then jammed his hat back on his balding head and fumbled his sword back into its sheath.
"No, not really."
They made their way down at a walk. If there had been any resistance, by the time they reached Square Deal, it was over. A man sat in the dust by the road, bloody hands pressed to his face, blinking at Swarbrick as he rode past. A sheep pen had been broken open, and the sheep all needlessly slaughtered, a dog already busy among the fluffy corpses. A wagon had been tipped on its side, one wheel still creaking hopelessly around in the air, while a Cantic and a Styrian mercenary argued savagely, in terms neither could understand, over the scattered contents. Two other Styrians were trying to kick the door of a forge from its hinges. Another had climbed onto the roof and was digging clumsily at it, using his axe like a shovel. Joubert sat on his huge horse in the center of the street, pointing with his outsized sword and booming orders, along with some incomprehensible utterances about the will of God. Swarbrick's pencil hovered, his fingertips worrying at its string binding, but he could think of nothing to write. In the end he scratched out, absurdly, "No heroism apparent."
"What are those idiots up to?"
murmured Temple. Several Cantics had roped a team of mules to one of the struts of the town's moss-crusted watchtower and were whipping them into a lather in an attempt to pull it down. So far they had failed. Swarbrick had observed that many of the men found it enjoyable simply to break things. The greater the effort required in putting them back together, the greater the pleasure. As if to illustrate this rule, four of Braccio's men had knocked someone to the ground and were administering a leisurely beating, while a fat man in an apron tried without success to calm them. Swarbrick had rarely observed violence of even the mildest sort. A dispute over narrative structure between two authors of his acquaintance had turned quite ugly, but that scarcely seemed to qualify now. Finding himself suddenly dropped into the midst of battle, as it were, Swarbrick felt both cold and hot at once, both terribly fearful and terribly excited. He shied away from the spectacle, yet longed to see more. Was that not what he had come for, after all, to witness blood and ordure and savagery at its most intense, to smell the guts drying and hear the wails of the brutalized? So he could say that he had seen it, so he could bring conviction and authenticity to his work, so he could sit in the fashionable salons of Adua and airily declaim on the dark truths of warfare. Perhaps those were not the highest of motives, but certainly not the lowest on show. He made no claim to be the best man in the circle of the world, after all, merely the best writer. Koska swung from his saddle, grunted as he twisted the life into his venerable hips, then, somewhat stiffly, advanced on the would-be peacemaker in the apron.
"Good afternoon. I am Nicomo Koska, Captain General of the Company of the Gracious Hand."
He indicated the four Styrians, elbows and sticks rising and falling as they continued their beating.
"I see you've already met some of my brave companions."
"Name's Clay,"
said the fat man, jowls trembling with fear.
"I own the store here."
"A store? Excellent. May we browse?"
Braccio's men were already carrying supplies out by the armload, under the watchful eye of Sergeant Friendly, no doubt ensuring any thieving from the company remained within acceptable limits. Thieving outside the company was, it appeared, entirely to be encouraged. Sawbreck shuffled his pencil around. A further note about the lack of heroism seemed superfluous.
"Take whatever you need,"
said Clay, showing his flour-dusted palms.
"There's no call for violence."
A pause, broken by the crashing of glass and wood and the whimpering of the man on the ground as he was occasionally and unenthusiastically kicked.
"Might I ask why you're here?"
Lawson stepped forward.
"We are here to root out disloyalty, Master Clay. We are here to stamp out rebellion."
"You're from the Inquisition?"
Lawson said nothing, but his silence spoke volumes. Clay swallowed.
"There's no rebellion here, I assure you."
Though Swarbrick sensed a falseness in his voice, something more than understandable nervousness.
"We're not interested in politics."
"Really?"
Lawson's profession evidently required a keen eye for deception also.
"Roll up your sleeves."
"What?"
The merchant attempted to smile, hoping to diffuse the situation with soft movements of his fleshy hands, perhaps, but Lawson would not be diffused. He jerked one hard finger, and two of his practicals hastened forward. Burly men, masked and hooded.
"Strip him."
Clay tried to twist away.
"Wait!"
Swarbrick flinched, as one of them punched the merchant soundlessly in his gut and doubled him up. The other ripped his sleeve off and wrenched his bare arm around. Bold script was tattooed from his wrist to his elbow, written in the old tongue, somewhat faded with age, but still legible. Lawson turned his head slightly sideways so he could read.
"Freedom and justice. Noble ideals with which we could all agree. How do they sit with those innocent citizens of the Union massacred by the rebels at Rostod, do you suppose?"
The merchant was only just reclaiming his breath.
"I never killed anyone in my life, I swear!"
His face was beaded with sweat.
"The tattoo was a folly in my youth. Did it to impress a woman. I haven't spoken to a rebel for 20 years.
"And you supposed you could escape your crimes here, beyond the borders of the Union?"
Swarbrick had not seen Lawson smile before, and he rather hoped he never did again.
"His Majesty's Inquisition has a longer reach than you imagine, and a longer memory. Who else in this miserable collection of hovels has sympathies with the rebels?"
"I dare say, if they didn't when we arrived," Swarbrick heard Temple mutter, "they'll all have them by the time we leave."
"No one!"
Clay shook his head.
"No one means any harm, me least of—"
"Where in the near country are the rebels to be found?"
"How would I know? I'd tell you if I knew."
"Where is the rebel leader, Conthus?"
"Who?"
The merchant could only stare.
I don't know.
We will see what you know. Take him inside.